And we are going to record the meeting.
Recording starts.
Yeah, we're
bullshit, and the quality sucks.
Terrible.
The timing of that was terrible.
She says in jest.
Exactly. So, welcome everybody. We'll get started. Yeah, just a few kind of quick announcements before we jump in. One, and again, I don't know if Renata, you met Katya before, but she's joining us. I think everybody else met her. Quick update on status of the whole data request. I know some of you have been apprised of this in one form or another. Bottom line, we, besides kind of the initial set of felony data we got from the Sentencing Commission in January, we haven't gotten anything more. I've been told to be that we may get the fine data, so we hope to find that, and then we'll be proceeding as necessary to kind of look to other agencies or institutions to find misdemeanor data and some of the others. For now, in our report, including the first report, the enactment plus kind of update, we have to provide sentencing statistics with that per the statute. We'll do the best we can with the stats that we've got, bottom line. They won't be current, they'll have some caveats, lots of caveats, but that's where we'll proceed. We also, the group that Don works with, the lab in the Office of the City Administrator, we're very close, but have not finally kind of completed an MOU with them to do some of the analysis statistics. So we have some expert, not Don, but somebody in that office who's a serious data scientist and can do some analysis for us. So.
At some point, are you going to explain to us what the nature of that analysis is? I'm not sure we've ever really been apprised of it.
Sure, you bet.
Not that you have to do it right at this point.
Yeah.
It's not on the schedule. I'm curious as
you
to
bet.
How we're going to use the data to help, in ranking or other things, and what that all entails, because that's
bet.
One of the things that I'm having my most difficulty wrapping my mind around.
You bet. That's right. So, the way in the kind of briefs, and then we'll come back to this later, email something around. The way the statute's written, it's along with recommendations shall provide charging, sentencing, and other relevant statistics for any offenses that are affected by the recommendations. So that's kind of one straight thing that we have to provide that. On a more general level, as we're looking at particularly, overlap, what offenses are even getting charged or used? We hit this before with, some offenses particularly with a number of the damage to property type offenses, vines, these sorts of things. A number of those we agreed, they're outdated, they're superfluous, they can go, but then there were a number where we had some hesitation. Mm-hmm. And so even knowing if they are charged at all or, show up at any point in the system, are they being used? So in a threshold manner, there's that kind of frequency. Obviously, again, looking at the back end on sentencing, having the ability to examine average, median sentences, but particularly the highs and the lows, right? If there's a minimum, are there, is there a lot of sentences around that minimum? Toward the maximum, are they anywhere near the maximum? I think, that's a relevant consideration when kind of determining proportionality is what's going on, what is current practice. So you want to be able to develop a sophisticated snapshot of what is going on now in order to put that out there and have that as a consideration. Not that it's ever it hasn't been charged, therefore it's of no use, right? Obviously, it may well be, particularly for certain kinds of offenses, but it might be strong evidence that it's not necessary, that it's another charge over here that's doing the work. That's a short explanation,
well,
but I can send around.
When we get closer to it, maybe we can have a more depth and stuff, only because of things in a sentencing commission and considerations we've had over the years about how, you know, when it's a plea bargain offense versus when it's usually charged with eight other offenses.
Yeah.
And, you know, those kind of considerations, that's why I'm really interested in how that analysis would actually operate.
Yeah, great. And good. Well, yes, moving forward, we'll definitely stay in touch with that. No current pending deadlines, but I wanted to let everybody know that so in just a couple days, this first report, the Enactment Plus report, we have one thing to talk about here, and then we'll be kind of issuing what I hope is the final version. We'll put it out there, and then at the next meeting, actually probably have a vote at the next meeting. But I think hopefully we settled out pretty much all the issues. We didn't receive any new comments. So there's one thing that we'll talk about today, and then you'll receive the final set of materials, which has virtually very, very few changes, and they'll be noted. I'll send a memo. Also, in the next couple of weeks, you'll receive some documents on recommendations regarding voluntary intoxication and willful blindness, and a few other kind of preliminary matters. And if you didn't see, it's a little hard to read. I have up on the screen here a part of the a work plan and schedule as part of the oversight process for the council, as well as, you know, by our statute, we have to, in an annual report, produce a work plan and schedule. I put those together. This is, I sent a copy, it's in the annual report, sent it out a couple weeks ago, and I wanted to highlight that, you know, kind of lists, you know, our targets for when at the staff level we're completing our drafts. Now, you know, first draft, right? You know, obviously, you know, some of these there's going to be multiple iterations. Others it may be simpler. But the target dates are up here, and the sequence might be of more use to everybody than anything else. So I don't want to go through the whole thing, but just wanted to flag that it's there. I could resend it, but again, it was emailed out to you, I think, on the 16th, 17th. Anyway, it's our annual report. It's on the website as well. And this is the schedule. And so, you know, for instance, it notes that, right, voluntary intoxication, willful blindness are there. Some of these preliminary things, you know, short title, the effective date, interaction with other code provisions. Some of the prefatory things that we had addressed initially back at the Sentencing Commission, we're doing the fuller write-up. Again, for all of these things, the length of the materials is going to vary, right? Voluntary intoxication, we want to make sure we explain better. You know, the short title and effective date, it's a paragraph. You know, so the amount of reading and what you can look forward to, it's going to vary, but those are the materials that you'll be receiving here in about the next 2 weeks or so. Wanted to also say, kind of as a logistical matter, unless there's kind of a strong difference of opinion on this, what we're going to do, you know, what we found already is we start to have multiple drafts, right? How do you keep track of that? How do you mark it so that it's accessible to you to see? Really hard, right? I think, you know, we can use comment boxes, we could do various things. I think our preference, though, strong preference, I think, would be to redline each version just off the prior version so that what you're getting only reflects the changes from the prior draft, and you'd have to pick up to go from draft 2 would show the redlining from draft 1. Draft 3 is not going to show the changes from number 1. It's only going to show the changes from 2 to 3. Just as a practical matter, I want it to be transparent, but my goodness, at some point, if you put too much on the page, it becomes cluttered. So I think we'll follow that practice. And let me see, anything else? We'll also, particularly as we get out this next group, we'll start to put together a compilation that's just the code language, not the commentary, but just the code language, just as it's a kind of a helpful thing to be able to flip to, particularly with the general provisions. Hey, what was that? You're coming up with voluntary intoxication. It's mentioning recklessness. What was the definition? So there'll be some place that you have the latest version all in one place for the statutory language. Let's think. Anything else to note? I don't think so. All right, so to jump in, again, there was just one issue with the first report, which is we talked about as a group. Dave was out at the meeting, and I think we talked around it. This is the question of whether to enact in the enacted Title 22 a short statement of legislative intent in the code itself, not legislative history, but in the code itself. That was the question, and it was based on this a comment from OAG. And when we talked about it last time, I think the sense was, okay, hey, there were some differing opinions. We need to check back with Dave. And I also had kind of floated to everybody that one way to resolve this is just to note this and present it on to the council's Office of General Counsel. This is such a specialized matter. They're going to have opinions. They're going to have to look at this. So to flag this particular matter. So what we did, and I'll let Rachel describe it, was put together this draft paragraph.
Yes, essentially just that the advisory group members had differing opinions about whether it was necessary to codify a short statement. This would be in addition to the prefatory longer statement of legislative intent that is in the beginning part of the bill. And so essentially this would just state that we are flagging it essentially for the council's office of the general counsel to consider and essentially determine whether it is necessary.
And by you said the longer part that's already in the bill. That is the section that we're talking about whether it needs to be codified or not, right?
Be a shorter statement.
A shorter statement than what is currently in there?
Well, so what she's referring to, and I can pull it up on the screen, right now in the bill...
It's that long laundry list that basically lists out every single change, he to she.
Oh, no, that's not what I was talking about.
Yeah, so that would remain in the bill. This is just codifying a short, simple statement of legislative intent regarding...
The thing that was above the, what I call above the line, so, in the bill itself.
So I think this is...
It would be something along these lines, codified.
The question is, right, whether to codify something along that line. That was the kind of the crux of the...
Okay, that's fine, of the comment. Yeah. Okay, that's...
So
you lost me on the lower thing.
Yes, all right. So the only change to kind of address the OAG concern on this matter wouldn't be to change the bill. It wouldn't be to... It's to flag this in the report front, in the end. This is the very end of the section on right before we get to the conclusion, saying, look, we had differing opinions on this, or the advisory group did. With the agreement of the advisory group, the commission qualifies its recommendations with a request that the council's Office of General Counsel consider this matter.
That meets OAG's concerns.
Right.
That actual concern was not from me, that was from Legal Counsel Division. And it's going to be bounced, as you said, to council by council anyhow. So I don't really see purpose of us spending a lot more time on it here.
So
as long as it's played for them to
good.
That's fine.
So that language covers for you. Is that an okay resolution for others too? If so, I think we're good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so what we'll do is we'll finalize this. There were some other kind of minor changes, technical little typos we found, various places. They will be highlighted and described. We'll get that out to you again in just a couple of days. And we'll probably label this a voting draft because, hopefully next meeting we can have a vote and hopefully have a consensus vote. If anybody has any last concerns, let me know. But I think otherwise this is good to go. All right, no other concerns on that. So then the second report, and we got back comments which were circulated from OAG and USAO. And I want to, give particular thanks to both Dave and Renata, but also I'm sure your offices, because other people had to get involved. So, thank you. It's very helpful, and encourage comments from everybody at any stage. So, there were some certain things that we wanted to address. We don't need to like bring them all up, I think, but I'm going to let Michael kind of walk through a few things.
Yeah, so again, really appreciate the comments. Thought they're really, really helpful. We can discuss any of the comments, but there were sort of like five basically that we thought in terms of that would be most useful for group discussion. The first was USAO's comment regarding the definition of possession. So, Richard, can you pull up the definition of possession?
This one?
No, the report.
Sorry.
Yeah.
It's
202D.
Yep. No. Sorry, I thought I had opened it, but I must have closed it, so I'll have to reopen it again.
So the gist of it is that under the proposed definition of possession, part of as an element of possession would be essentially non-momentary, and the basic rationale there is there are a few different components. One, it's just a question of balancing risks of convicting innocent people, whether or not in the view of at least some courts, non-momentary is kind of inherent in the idea of possession. Fleeting possession just isn't considered to be part of it. And then there are various jurisdictions which specifically have rules regarding the length of time and regarding the possession. So USAO pointed out that it's a change. That's definitely right. Under current district law, there's an affirmative defense for innocent or momentary possession. To benefit from the defense, the accused has to show not only an absence of criminal purpose, but also that his possession was excused and justified as stemming from an affirmative effort to aid and enhance social policy underlying law enforcement. So what this would do is cut out the momentary part of that and turn it into an affirmative element. But as recognized in the report, it is definitely a change in law. USAO pointed out something worth this discussing, and staff agrees definitely something worth considering.
I was in mine as well, and I think my hypo was two guys walk down the street, right? They go,
No, it just starts like a bad joke, but go for it.
Two guys walk down the street, they go over to somebody who's selling heroin, one guy says to the other one, I'd like to buy heroin. This exchange of money for drugs, the drug goes into the other guy's hand, and the second person to walk down the street room is actually an undercover officer and immediately arrests him, like in a fraction of a second.
That's right.
Right? So my question in my memo was why would we introduce this as an element in that factual scenario? Because it is clear that at the time the person had the heroin in their hand, that they are guilty of possession of it, and in fact introducing that, well, they didn't have it long enough to get rid of it, seems to confuse the issue.
Right. No, so that's also a well-taken point. That was next up on the list. No, but I mean, the two things are obviously interconnected. On that issue, I think kind of our staff's preliminary position is that commentary could clearly express that. So the commentary talks about what the factors are that would need to be considered in terms of determining what's sufficient, and there could be a clear statement that where there's prior knowledge regarding the illegal nature of the contraband,
I think we've had this discussion before. On something of that basic of a nature, I'm really a proponent of being it into the code, because legislative history only goes to when there's an ambiguity.
Sure.
And there may be no ambiguity, and such that, that on appeal we would be arguing that point and go to legislative intent.
Sure.
So my suggestion really is to somehow bifurcate those two situations or
query whether as a practical matter.
Right. We don't think that as a practical matter the way that we would charge those, it makes any difference.
Right.
To be perfectly honest. And we ran several hypotheticals and it all sort of comes down to what the thing is. Sometimes is it a gun? Is it drugs? Is it, a cat?
Yeah.
So for us, it is purely the issue of, it is something that the government previously did not have to prove.
Sure.
And it was an affirmative defense. And we just...
We're
tagging it.
Yeah.
It's one of those places.
Yeah, and I think I would, one point or to make sure we're clear on, though, is I think, the scenario you marked out should be there should be liability, right? So the question is how to communicate that, right? And again, Michael's suggestion was to do it through commentary entry. We'll look at other options too. And again, both beg the more basic question of, you know, should this be an affirmative defense? Should it be?
Well, and also to say one thing looming in the background in terms of how important or perhaps unimportant this is that attempted possession is an offense, at least under current district law. And, you know, in all these situations, and it's also penalized the same. Now, you know, what happens in...
When the code is finished. Really,
right, right. yeah. No, but it's just to say that in any of these, you know, even, so to say this, the split-second scenario that you raise is definitely valid. It's definitely one that I think we'd all agree there ought to be liability in. Query whether, as a practical matter, how often you're going to have split-second by-bus operations, whereas... You know.
No, I agree with the split second, and I only did that to highlight the point. But it does beg the question in the commentary mm-hmm. about how long does it take for somebody who notices that there's something in a bag to get rid of it. And that then that time element itself becomes something that becomes amorphous, right? Amorphous, I don't know if that's right.
No, that's right. But it's like, that's no... So, right, the commentary lays out the factors that would go to that. And it's just the same as like every other area of law with respect to possession, right? When it comes to constructive possession, there are multiple factors that are considered. I mean, the general notion of applying multiple factors to resolve a rule is this kind of, you know, standard practice. Now, you know, whether or not there's costs and benefits in terms of introducing that, whether or not the benefits are outweighed in this scenario is, for, you know, an open question. And definitely something worth discussing.
Yeah, and does anybody, you know, so right now what we have, right, you know, it's the highlighted, it's for a period of time sufficient to allow the actor to terminate his or her control of the property. Any suggestions for ways to be more precise or, because I hear you, Dave, part saying it's a question for, you know, trying to draw, have as many bright lines as we can about what
this is. Otherwise,
I could
see me in the jury instruction committee arguing with, you know, with the defense bar, saying, well, you know, that has to be in the jury instruction, right? And then we have to end up arguing in court, well, what is the period of time in a situation where, at least that I'm posing, it's obvious that the person knew what it was. It makes perfect sense where it's not clear. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not arguing with the point that, you know, somebody picks up a bag and they go, whoa, there's a gun in there. They shouldn't have an opportunity to...
Right. I'm just wondering, as a drafting matter, like, if you do this, how do you state it, right? You know, or what...
Do you have
this
commentary?
Better?
Yeah.
Where can I see that?
The scroll below.
Where you said there are factors.
Yeah.
That's the part I'm interested
in. Yeah.
Speed me.
Pass that.
Permission.
The next one.
Right.
There.
There we go.
So the second paragraph.
I was interested because it seemed like, I wanted to know how you talked about it, because I wondered if it was trying to do something with knowing, right, which is what takes care of Dave's, where you're like, can I please have the heroin? Well, I know that's what I'm about to get. And certainly your example is, but the getting rid of it is clearly beyond the knowing. It is another piece of it, so that's...
Yeah. There's also a whole host of ways this sort of thing can happen, right? I mean, Dave's example highlights the you know the nature of the thing before you pick it up, but the other but the alternative is you don't know the nature of the thing, you pick it up and then discover it. Another version of it is someone gives it to you, you don't know the nature of the thing, then you discover it. The, you know, that there's the sort of range of issues that that's would be addressed here is pretty significant. So anyways, it's definitely something worth further consideration. Staff would, you know, be happy to hear any comments that, you know, in the future on that. So yeah, the next issue. Oh, sorry.
No, because I think that it is the knowing, adding the knowing part to the culpability. Because I mean, you can have situations where you pick it up off the ground and you figure out, oh, there's drugs in there. So it's not, to me, it's not even just about sufficient time, because different people respond to that differently. I would hope that my children would pick it up, realize this is, that it's drugs, and that they would throw it back on the ground. As a parent, I'm not sure I believe that that's the right thing to do. So I will possess it, I can tell you, longer so that I can think of ways to more appropriately get it out of my possession. And I'll say it on the tape. We wouldn't prosecute that.
Right. Yeah.
But it's sort of knowing that moment, right? Because the drugs, presumably, you put in the trash can, the gun, you don't, that somehow was in the plastic bag. But that was it. It's sort of the, like, it's like, how much grace period do you get, right? Like, knowing is what starts the time. And then there's the, like, how much time do you get for the sort of physical part, and how much... How much is it? What you need to do is throw it on the ground,
And to add, like, one final piece is, so, right, again, DC case law recognizes an affirmative defense, a lot of this. So on top of all these issues, it's a question of where do you want to distribute the burdens? In other words, what things, right, anytime you put something as an affirmative defense, just creates the risk, creates a greater likelihood of conviction.
I like the definition.
And, you know, it's
not on her side.
It's hard, you know, there are hard decisions there. This is just taking a sliver of that affirmative defense, the temporal aspect, and putting it there, leaving still a significant part of it, right? So in Renata's example with her kid, so this still wouldn't provide protection. This still would require the affirmative defense of, so you had it for sufficient time to get rid of it, but you decided you're going to do, you know, you're going to take it to the police station, let's say. This would not necessarily cover that. That would still have to be raised as an affirmative defense.
And that's actually the question that I was going to have, because you have the line there that the factors of the dangerousness of the object and the ease with which the object can be safely disposed of. So if I see a machine gun,
right,
I can hold on to it a really long time, because a machine gun is really dangerous if somebody else hands on the street. So maybe an hour, half an hour, while I'm lugging this thing around to make sure nobody else has it, is a sufficient time. Because using that analysis, right, doesn't that sound like a machine gun I should be able to hold
really long time? On, David,
or is it the opposite?
Than that.
No.
Well, you're going directly to the police station, but...
Then you're
what is it? You're always like speeding recklessly because your wife is actually in the car having a baby and you're on your way to the hospital. I mean, you can do better than...
Okay, I'm sorry.
There's a reason you're not going right to the police station.
You have a really...
Yeah, but I wasn't there,
right? You have a
very
brown tan.
Right,
pulled
exactly.
Over while you're trying to do
exactly.
That.
Right.
So I'm just merely walking in the direction of the police station, and it's going to take a while for me to get there with my machine gun.
It's hard to draft a criminal code, right? It's really hard to figure out which aspects someone addressed.
But to bolster her point, under current law, I believe you find me with the semi-automatic, it then is up to me to say, look, I was heading towards the police station, not us to say, where is 7D from where you were stopped, and you actually pointed in that direction.
Right. So, it is true that it would change the burdens. Now, I should say, the framing is trying to be as objective as possible here. so that the goal was to try and do as light of a touch as possible, in the sense that the way it's set up is to provide an objective evaluation, so that to address this, you don't need to start inquiring into subjective mental state issues.
But am I correct that what that means is the more dangerous the object, the longer the time, not the more dangerous the object, the shorter the time?
Not necessarily, I don't think.
It just depends on the situation, depending on the circumstances.
Yeah.
Well, why is dangerous in there at all?
Dangerous is in there because presumably the nature of the object will have a significant impact on what you would do with it, or what's appropriate.
Why are you characterizing it? I think is what you're saying.
Sure.
It's simply the nature. Because what if it's the cat that you're trying to return to the rightful owner, sort of possession, sort of thing? It's that the cat isn't dangerous.
Right.
It's the nature that you recognize the cat and know it belongs to Rachel and not the person, you know, on whose porch she's found it.
Right, yeah.
I think that's an excellent point. Yeah. We could generalize it more to nature. I think, you know, like, it does seem like often dangerousness is going to court, right? Like, you know...
dangerous, like with an attempt statute, dangerous implies that you can intervene... Law enforcement can intervene earlier. So the more dangerous an attempt is, the earlier law enforcement can intervene.
Right.
So normally there is some kind of causal relationship. I think David's right. I do think we should either take it out or have an understanding about whether, because it's dangerous, it means it's less or more time that you get to possess it.
Yeah, sure. Sure, I think that's...
Did I miss what was going on? It seems like, in the end, what we need is the safely dispose of, right?
Right.
Which is related to the dangerousness. We sort of don't need the dangerousness for whatever trouble it's causing people.
So if you have a bomb that's about to go off, right? Like, you want to put that away in a place where...
No, get the fuck out of there. I don't understand.
I'm saying, if
I'm fine with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Possession won't be the issue in it.
Right, exactly. Sorry.
Yeah, no, you know, the general... What was intended was to say that if you're in a situation where the immediate abandonment poses a public safety risk, that would extend the length of time.
Like the gun, like the because it's the safely disposal.
Yeah, you don't want somebody. Yeah, right. Exactly. Sorry.
So the drugs,
the Scooby snacks by an elementary school. Right, you want to be able to move that further away, right? Scooby snacks, synthetic cannabinoids.
Why don't we stick with? I recommend we stick with drugs and guns.
Those apparently are drugs. I thought we were moving back to cats and dogs.
Scooby snacks are a brand name for synthetic cannabinoids.
Is that okay?
And they come with Scooby.
Gave this all
Scooby's face on it. No, that's why I picked it, because there's a cartoon character on it. So that, by an elementary school, I'm just trying to highlight what you're saying, might be a more dangerous situation than that in the middle of K Street.
Right.
So would...
But the safely disposed of does the work for us.
Yes.
Right. Is there work being done besides the safely disposed of? I guess, because otherwise we could eliminate the reference to dangerous of the object... And ease is definitely a factor. You know, I think of the car example, right? This is presence in a motor vehicle containing a firearm, right? You know, that whole opinion about the ease of getting out of the car,
okay, it has to slow down.
You know, and like I can certainly I open the glove compartment, I find whatever it is, a handgun, machine gun, or So safely disposed, but there's do you want to put any other qualifiers? Do dangerousness, if that isn't really if that is already the work's being done by safely dispose of, does ease, do we want to go into this and I guess actually let me scroll down to
why
that
are you so but this applies
Yeah.
This possession definition is going to apply across the board.
Right, that's right.
So you're thinking very clearly about drug possession
and guns.
Or firearms possession. But it seems to me it's going to have to be a little broader than that, because sometimes the possession, the issue isn't going to be disposal. It's going to be something else about it. It's going to be replacement of it, or...
Do you have an example?
Maybe you have something is other than a gun or a drug, so you're possessing it, but you're returning it or doing something else with it, and it's not because you're disposing of it.
It's
you're
like just, the cat.
You're right. You're returning.
It's like
restored property.
Relinquishing. Yeah, yeah. The cat is not that is dangerous. I mean, you could have a dangerous, you know, feral cat, but it's not in that instance. Is that it won't, without being fettered, stay where it is so that the rightful owner can get it.
Right.
I'm just cautioning. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think, you know, there's been a really good job done with this general provision section, but we're going to always have to be revisiting it a little bit to make sure that everything that we're doing applies sensibly in other contexts.
So it's both appropriately disposed of and safely.
Yeah, so the only thing I'd say is, just to be clear, the innocent aspect of the affirmative defense still would exist and still would have to be raised as an affirmative defense. There's a lot of the things that we're starting to talk about now go to why, you know, like, so you had it for enough time that you could have disposed of it, but you had it longer because you returned it to its rightful owner, right? All that is still addressed and still covered by current district law as the affirmative defense. All this is doing is extracting a small piece of that inquiry.
Oh,
and
that's true.
Yeah.
Because you could let the cat go.
Right.
Nobody told you to pick up the cat.
Right. So, and so, right, one could arguably put incorporate that whole affirmative defense as an element. That's not the recommendation, right? But, you could see an argument for it, because in those situations, the person's blameless. A person who returns stolen laptop to its owner is not only blameless, they're praiseworthy. I mean, that's, you know, we hope people would do that. So one could argue for the entire piece to be part of it. The recommendation here is keep that as currently is, and just taking out one small piece, which is the temporal aspect.
I apologize. I have to go. I told you I had to leave early. I don't think that I agree with this approach that you're taking. I just don't think dangerousness is doing any kind of.
Yeah, I think that's right. So I think that's probably right. Yeah.
I apologize for having to leave early. I'll see you guys.
Thank you.
Well, my suggestion, and I haven't really put this out, is, so I may change my
phones.
Is the nature of the object and the ease with which the object could be appropriately disposed of under the circumstances.
I mean,
I don't know.
Yeah.
Well,
because I'm concerned about the computer.
So
why do I think about a computer in terms of safety?
I do think the computer's an interesting issue. I don't want to argue the other side appropriately gives me more room. But what do you do with the laptop? Because that is one where, like, it's perfectly safe, but someone's going to steal it, right? So Renata leaves her computer here, and I take it. Because leaving it here... So what is that? So I get the affirmative defense?
Right, yeah.
So I hold on to it, and if I don't go right to her office, this isn't about safety. This is where I have to do the affirmative defense.
You still would have possessed it, but notwithstanding that.
Okay,
yeah.
And that's just life.
Yeah.
Not using for other reasons, right?
Yeah. I mean, we kind of already dealt with it, and, you know, we haven't worked up RSP yet, so we couldn't tell you where it's going to go, but this is in the prior iteration of the project. This is something we dealt with in terms of whether or not the intent to restore is an affirmative defense or an element.
Right.
And so
so for example, with receiving stolen property, it's not the possession. What gets the person off is they don't have intent to deprive.
That's
right. She's never going
to.
That's all circumstance, you know.
Right.
Everything you do, how long you keep it, where you go in the interim, whether you make a call, all of that goes into the analysis of whether you intended to deprive or whether you're in the process of trying to return something.
So why don't we put a bookmark down here? We have definitely some stuff to chew on, and we'll, you know,
we'll specifically look at the dangerousness prong and whether just broadening that to nature of the object and otherwise phrasing this Yeah, sounds good.
So that, I'm still wondering how it writes jury instruction without, because if that's in the code, it's going to be an element that's how do I address that in my
So there's a general question that we have, and it's something we've talked about. So, for example, under DCCA case law, and it's well established that causation is an element of every offense, right? And yet, it's not like in every simple assault case, every felony assault case, every offense that has a result element, there are causation jury instructions being given, right? So there's a sense in which it's not necessarily the case that every time something is an element, it has to be incorporated
right.
into the instructions.
Or it's bracketed. We do that all the time in instructions. Where
right.
we sort of say,
the
like,
bracketing
if
is
this is the thing
way,
you're fighting over, well, here's the thing to fight over. You don't have to tell the jury to find something that, like, that just isn't the issue.
Yeah, but right now that makes sense, and I get it that we do that where it's like common law and we're translating it. But isn't I thought that was actually the beauty of the elementizing mm-hmm. approach, mm-hmm. where you know each thing that the government must prove, mm-hmm. and you are able to toggle on and off
right,
for each and
definition.
Every element.
But that's the commentary. That's not the code.
No, but but even if you put it in the definition, it's the definition. So you'd say like possessed the stolen lap, you know, possessed the laptop, and only if you were sort of then fighting over. Did she really possess it? Would you be like? Would you then fight over? Well,
so unless the
jury,
defense in every case brings up the, but I only had it for a fraction of a second.
Well, but
and
sometimes
then it's,
not.
Then
sometimes it's like
issue.
You got the wrong person. Right. You know.
But again, like I understand. Like we shouldn't make too much about the distinction between common law versus mm-hmm. statute. Again, just to go back to causation, whether or not you codify causation, when the highest state court in a given jurisdiction holds that causation is an element, that means the issues are identical. So everything that we're talking about right now is part and parcel with the question of, under current district law, A, does the jury have to be instructed on causation in every result element offense, from simple assault all the way up to homicide in every case? And B, if the defendant requests it, regardless of what the facts say, is he entitled to it? Those are coextensive issues, and there are, I assume, spend some time thinking about it, many comparable situations where you have something that is, quote, an element of the offense, but you're not necessarily having jury instructions on in every case where it's not particularly
sure. I mean, we're like, we happen to be looking at the definition of possession, but it actually, right, had knowing in it. Like,
yeah,
like every word could be defined, which mm-hmm. we don't do. We
exactly.
don't do that.
It should work. I'm going to
well, so,
go
so,
out there on this.
Sure.
Elementizing has a can theoretically have a precision to it that in my mind would make jury instructions
superfluous
necessary.
Right. Yes.
And therefore I think Dave and I have this thing where if you have a definition you ought to be able to take the handles of it and insert it. And that is what is a complication.
Yes, yes. But you don't have to do it every time. But
right.
if what you're fighting over is
that's
this,
right.
then you'll pick it up and you'll insert it. But that you can do that doesn't mean every time the word possession is used in instruction, everyone's going to be like, you know, you need to fill in the definition. Because everyone will be like, that's not what we're fighting over here. It'll be there. It'll be maybe it'll be definitions in the front of the red book or something of like cut and paste.
Yeah, so I should just say, over the months I've been reviewing jury instructions from other jurisdictions because I, you know, to really get a sense of how these things
tread
go down. And in the general sense,
I've got to ask you, I'd like to see another jurisdiction that has adopted
a
model penal code type approach like this, and I'd like to see what that looks like
even though
firearms context, drug context, receipt of stolen property, theft context.
Sure.
That might be helpful.
Yeah. And I think, again, I don't think we need to cut up on this more, but it is it's going to be a broad issue, right? Like, look, on all this stuff, again, jurisdiction, right? Like, you know...
But you're picking the elements, I mean, with all due respect, you're picking the elements that typically are not challenged in, you know, yes, if D.C., if the issue with that particular case is D.C., but if it's cocaine, you got to allege cocaine. I mean, there are some elements... In the old jury books, they used to call them essential elements to get the difference between the stuff we're talking about and the stuff you're talking about. Sure. Because it may not be an essential element in a particular case, whether it happened in D.C. or whether causation was happening. So we removed the essential, I don't know, 10 years ago.
But I think it's important to say, though, that, like, right, once you cross that line, and it is recognized both concurrent practice and that, again, the clearly recognized elements of the offense, they exist, whether they're in common law or in the code. Not all of them have to be expressed in the jury instructions. Then it's a matter of, okay, well then when does it not? That isn't, I want to kind of administratively say, that's not our job. Like, I totally get that, like,
I only brought it up as an example of why I think it's important, because otherwise I think, my example was in drafting a jury instruction, the first thing I look at is the words of the statute.
Right.
And I could see an argument that says, well, the statute says X.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And then it leaves it to me to argue that, well, the commentary sort of, and whether how that argument flies or not, as opposed to it being in a code. I don't mean to beat a dead horse.
You understand?
Okay.
Whether it's in commentary or in the actual code, maybe you're already here, but can we go where it says, so we've moved past talking about two main factors, right? So we'll sort of say intended to focus on sort of like something like depending on the nature of the object, the ease with which, right? Like we're no longer distinguishing it.
I should say, it's tough when you're thinking about these things, it's worth, particularly when good issues are raised, it's worth having a few moments outside of the meeting to sort of like, to chew it over, but yes, that generally seems like the direction. Sorry, go. No,
that's it. That's all I was going to say. Great. That's it.
Great.
Next issue.
Great. Okay. Substantial step. So USAO raised a good point in their comments concerning the impact that. The proposal here is to replace the substantial step factor, which is currently globally articulated as the but-for causation test, with a more traditional but-for causation formulation, which also then, through a bright line rule, addresses the least controversial version of problem for but-for causation, which is concurrent sufficient causes. So the would not have occurred but for, or, and then bright line rule, in a situation where the conduct of two or more persons contributes to a result, the conduct of each alone would have been sufficient. What's being envisioned there is a situation where A and B both fire their gun at C's head at the same time. They're not working in concert with one another. C dies. Under the sort of strict reading of but for, you can't say either is a but for. But this would create a bright line exception there. The recommendation is for this to replace the current district approach, which is a substantial factor test, in the commentary and analysis of nationwide legal trends. It goes through highlighting a variety of the ambiguities created by the substantial factor test. All that aside, USAO raises the point in their comments that the urban gun battle theory of causation, which has gotten a lot of focus recently, Fleming, the 2016 November decision in Fleming, which there's currently a petition rehearing en banc. All of those cases, in formulating the causation requirement, also use a substantial factor test, like every other factual causation formulation in district law. So the question is, what impact, if any, would this have? Say that staffs did not intend, by replacing substantial factor with the more traditional but-for approach, have any intent to change that, nor does staff believe that it would. So in Roy, the original case from which gun battle causation originates, there's a footnote that cites to persuasive authority from five other jurisdictions as supporting that theory. Three of those five apply but-for causation in the course of applying or judicially creating gun battle theory causation. So, and I should also say that the Model Penal Code gives an example in its commentary that looks very much like this, saying, you know, no problem with the formulation. So, which is all just to say that staff's view is that adopting it or replacing the substantial factor test with this formulation would have no change on, or would not preclude, I should say, would not preclude gun battle causation theory liability. So yeah, but we will keep an eye on the Fleming petition.
Yeah, I think just the follow-up point though is to say, like, okay, so one, this was not intended to preclude it. There's authority for in other jurisdictions using this kind of thing for gun battle, and right. So like there's a way that we think it's workable as is, but we'll keep looking at it. The petition's out there, and I think again, like, this is one of those where Renata was the last one to remind us that again, we'll have to circle back. You know, there's right. You know, compass liability, get rid of the urban just gun battle theory. You know how that is. Ends up being formulated or incorporated into other provisions. We don't know. We haven't sorted that out, right? Like, so I think it's absolutely right to flag it. We don't want to, and we want to be clear that it's not like at this point we're trying to like somehow backdoor way or undo that. But yeah.
So
what do you do as a matter of
practice?
We would, in commentary,
clarify that this is not intended to preclude
this.
Right, so just to be clear, by the way, in A shoots at B, B responds by shooting at C. There's no question that but for A's action, C wouldn't have done. Right. So in this sort of in the simplest situation where you have the shot being fired from, let's say, a co-participant in a gun battle, it's very like the but-for causation is obvious. As the number of people become greater and greater, there may be some greater complexities, but you know, at the end of the day, the principle operative here is no different than in any other context. And so staff's general view is that, you know, there should be one standard of causation, it should be clear, and it should apply, you know, across offenses. So, yeah, but, you know, at minimum, definitely clarify through commentary that this is not intended to preclude gun battle theory causation liability in any way.
And then to your process point, so, look, We'll put together a second draft of this, right? Michael's got a lot on his plate, but we'll put together a second draft, you know, based on these comments, the changes. Again, I'm not going to get to talk about all of them, but like, and this I think is going to be a point too, where like, fine, we amend the commentary at least to say it doesn't preclude, you know, gun battle liability. This was not intended to preclude this. It's still going to hang out there until we kind of deal with this. And that may not be until accomplice liability later on,
right.
Or frankly, even beyond that, you know, onto kind of looking at murder and like, you know, like, so we can make some changes now, but partly, right, we're just kind of, and again, you know, the if there's an en banc, well, then it's 5 years till we get an opinion out. Not their fault. They don't have the judges. But,
really? Because that's a safe
keep going.
Keep going.
So I should just say that generally, all of the issues that both OAG and USAO raised regarding any revisions that would follow from there. I should just say, I don't think we'll have really any import on, let's say, what we do with property offenses or what mental state we apply. Or, and then they say up until now, it may be that voluntary intox gets released or you know, and there are comments coming back where it could have significant implications for what we, you know, for what happens in property offenses. But particularly, it's property and then drug offenses, right?
Yeah, so in general, we're kind of the same we did last time. So if we don't, at this point, there's still going to be some outstanding questions on these general provisions where we can kind of address this, right, by changing the commentary, but frankly, that flag is planted, and we'll need to circle back to it later on.
As long as we maybe have some way, we came up with some convention before of noting that.
Exactly.
Perhaps we continue.
And your comments do that, like in a very formal way. You have preserved that in a great way. So
in 9 months from now,
yeah,
will we come out with a recommendations for Chapter 2 final? Because only final until we review all those other things that we did.
So, right, process point on this, my thought is this. In a couple of months, we will have gotten through most of the general provisions we need to start moving forward, to look at property offenses and drug offenses, which, you know, they don't raise some of the complexities that, right, you know, murder, some of the assault stuff is going to, you know, it just, at that point, again, I'd like to get a sense of whether there are additional outstanding issues we want to talk about. Assuming people are generally, like, we can't fix in time what we have at that point, but we need a fairly solid basis in order to start with property and drugs. So that's what I want to check in on that. It's not going to be a vote. It's not going to be like, here's the final set of recommendations before we move on to property offenses. Not that. It'll still be like, the last thing we have was that second draft, which is out there, and, you know, that's where we're working from. Practically, and then we'll go forward. We'll add things in. Accomplice liability, hopefully, come this fall, and we'll have to do that before we get into offenses against persons. And look, at the end, there will be a final version. The final version, the voting version, is at the very end.
And so maybe it's the nomenclature. You know, you call things draft number one of chapter whatever, draft number two, da 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 da. Maybe they become semifinal. So they have the word final in the meaning. We're just about there, but they
subject
so
to necessary changes. That's an interesting point. I'll think about a nomenclature that kind of like symbolizes that, or you know, expresses that. But that's the intent for the process. Does that address?
Yes, thank you.
Good. Well,
So just the other the related point is an issue that USAO raised on legal causation. Pretty much everything just said applies to this as well. But the USAO's general point was that an intervening force.
Sorry. Run away on my own.
So USAO's point, which is well taken, is that if an intervening force or act is reasonably foreseeable, then it can't negate legal causation. With respect to force, I think that's probably right, and there's some super fluidity. With respect to act, actually, that's not as clear. Though, so if you just look at the gun battle causation cases, where you know, I think that it is fair to say that characterize those cases as standing for the principle that when so long as a third party's act is reasonably foreseeable, that doesn't break the chain of legal causation. However, outside that context, it's less clear. So first, just some straightforward, simple hypotheticals. A asks B to lend him mountain climbing equipment for a trip to Everest. He lends it, B goes, B gets harmed. I think it's fair to say that it's reasonably foreseeable that if you're lending someone mountain climbing equipment for a, you know, super risky trip to Everest, that harm is reasonably foreseeable. I think in that situation, you probably say, even if it was reasonably foreseeable, you wouldn't say that A is, or that B is the legal cause of that harm.
Who got harmed?
Yeah, so...
Or the mountain equipment.
Right, so there's an... So person A owns mountain equipment. Person B asks, can I borrow it? A says, sure, no problem. B then goes on his own volition and hurts himself.
But where's your intervening...
Right, so the intervene... The general proposition...
It's not A's fault.
Right. We wouldn't say...
It's true. They couldn't go up Everest without the equipment, but that's not A's fault.
Getting injured there was reasonably foreseeable. When someone goes mountain climbing on Everest, that it is a... We still wouldn't necessarily say that they're criminally responsible, that they're the legal cause of that.
You need a better... I don't know.
So yeah. Let's try another one. Okay.
Try another one.
Yeah, sure.
Let's have a...
No mountain climbers in the room. No mountain climbers.
Okay,
move on.
Okay. A writes a news article for National Women...
Do you know what that little thing is called?
Caribbean.
Oh, I did.
Yes.
Oh, I thought you meant the little
Mr.
thing that...
Mountain climber.
The little thing that you put in. My daughter, this was the one book she checked out of the lot. My little five-year-old daughter. She wants to learn how to mountain climb.
That's her thing. So I made it.
Oh, that's
it.
You're on it. You're on it.
All right. Let's try another. All right.
Let's see if I can do this.
Yeah. A writes a news article for National Women's Publication encouraging wives to beat their husbands at least once a year to establish their superiority. It is reasonably foreseeable, but it's a big, real popular publication, that some wives may read this and say, yeah, I'm going to go do it. That being said, although reasonably foreseeable, in this situation, the intervening act of a third party breaks a chain of legal causation.
So husband can't be like women's magazine or author of article.
The general principle here is the question of whether or not the intervening act of a third party can break the chain ever of legal causation, even if it's reasonably foreseeable. Drag racing.
I see.
So let's move to some real cases. So DC has never resolved it, but there are competing precedents. I think the majority rule is when A and B voluntarily engage in drag racing.
Case law is a little dated on this, but
yeah. Yeah. B injures, B kills, right? So A and B voluntarily engage in drag racing. B kills himself.
No pedestrian.
B kills himself. A is not the legal cause, even if reasonably foreseeable. The point trying to be made is that there are situations where the intervention, where...
Let's not do felony murder.
The last thing I was going to say is, and probably the most important, is felony murder, which is to say that, and again, based upon preliminary research, it's not clear whether the issue has been resolved in a district, but the majority trend is to say that where you have two accomplices in the felony, the victim responds by killing. Do you want to go? Sorry, Don.
Before we get to felony murder.
Yeah. Yes.
Where this comes up all the time is in hospitals. So someone is injured during some type of altercation. They go to the hospital, and it depends on how negligent the staff is, how seriously injured the person was. And so they take all that stuff into account. Did the doctor or the nurse actually kill the patient rather than...
Those cases tend to turn on a reasonable foreseeability.
See, that's a challenge. And sorry, I don't mean to get super esoteric on the examples, but just say that there is a sliver outside the realm of reasonable foreseeability where even if it's reasonably foreseeable, the intervening act of a third party nevertheless would break the chain.
Oh, right, because those you're not expecting.
Yeah, so in a lot of those cases, the way they frame... Now, again, the term reasonable foreseeability kind of gets thrown around. Having thought this through and spent a little more time on it, staff may ultimately recommend. So, you know, the animating idea here was that by using the magic phrase reasonable foreseeability and codifying it, we would kind of loop in all the relevant case law. Yeah. And the problem, though, is that it's not conceptually, and USAO's comment kind of picks up on this. Is there some internal tension by trying to frame the whole thing in terms of reasonable foreseeability, but then saying, defining reasonable foreseeability as when, you know, or there's a intervening force.
So there are like 100 cases where what the judge does is say like, oh, this really bad person did this really bad thing, and, you know, it, somebody intervened, and so they just find them, they find them as the cause. Or if it's a seemingly innocent person who does something that, you know, or less guilty person, less bad person who does it, then they say, oh, no, that breaks the chain of causation.
Right.
Right? So the, this whole chain of causation thing,
it's a fiction.
In the literature and in the case law everywhere, is basically like you're giving judges a tool to say, should this person be convicted? The way the model penal code deals with this is to say, is the result so distant from the act of the defendant that you are not willing to hold them liable?
So it's Paul Square.
Everybody, and then the people who say reasonable.
In the civil context, it's Paul Square.
Oh,
right?
Renata.
Judge Cardone.
Yeah.
That is fine.
So, and
that's the one where, like, that's
that
the train. That's the
train, train with the clock at the end of the platform.
Good Lord.
Yeah, so, Judge Cardone. Civil, so a few things. One, the civil, proximate cause in civil law, and what is typically different than proximate cause or legal causation in criminal law, because you have moral condemnation at issue beyond, you know, just mm-hmm. a question of economic compensation. The other, right, what I'd say is what we tried to do was kind of bootstrap in the model penal code language into reasonably foreseeable. The overall, and this kind of is a theme that pervades all many of the most important recommendations in general part, is transparency. Like, if what's happening are intuitive judgments of justice, then that should be clear and not hidden. What Don, like, so accurately points out is just, like, the way things develop is this reasonable foreseeability has kind of become this, like, has a patina of sort of, like, descriptive accuracy, when in fact all it is a kind of like an empty concept that is being filled with whatever the intuitive sense is in any given situation.
But isn't it always going to be that anyhow?
Well, no, it's just that if you read, like, for example, if you read DCCA case law, it has a real descriptive feel to it, like on proximate cause. The evolution of, well, intervening causes and, well, but it's not a responsive intervening cause. There is a sense in which the reader is left with the idea that what's being done here is judges are just applying these kind of fact-based rules and working through it, when at the end of the day, it's typically just a bunch of kind of common law-esque language dressing up this just underlying intuitive gut judgment. And if that's what's happening, it should be, first of all, the jury is, at least at a trial, better situated to be making that, and second of all, at least it should be done clearly.
So to talk through Don's example of the hospital, I get shot in the chest, and I go to the hospital, and I pick up staph infection.
It's a case.
And I die.
Yeah.
There's
right?
a case. Yeah.
Staph infection. That's reasonably foreseeable, right? That staph infection is so common in hospitals that if I die, that's murder. If I'm in a hospital and a nurse walks by and knocks over the EKG machine and it crunches, hits me in the head, and it knocks out the oxygen I'm having, that's not reasonably
foreseeable. Or she puts the tube down the wrong pipe.
Mostly.
And so, yeah.
Well, I didn't want to use that one because I don't know how foreseeable nurse is shoving the wrong tube down.
And it depends on how bad they think the person is who did that. Like, you can find case law going
on. No, but I'm just, now I want to apply that to the definition. That's what I'm saying.
Well,
the question then becomes is, well, what is too remote?
Yeah, right. No, and there are factors. Like, the point is, there is no clear test for any of these things, which, and so the theme kind of throughout the general part is, and you go to the commentary on this, you know, lays out factors that the jury could consider in resolving it. I mean, it's trying to structure legal decision making in a more transparent and hopefully uniform way, with the hope that at the end of the day, that, you know, what you end up with is more uniformity, less disparity, and perhaps filling at least some of the space, let's say that unconscious cognitive bias might fill with by sort of structuring the deliberation. So that's the kind of the general goal. To the more specific point, though, on whether or not there is something other than reasonable foreseeability, or let's say remoteness and accidentalness, or the extent to which the outcome is accidental, there is an additional component, I think, which is the intervening volitional acts of a third party. And right, so if you just look at the gun battle causation cases, you are left with the sense that that can never break the chain. But when you go outside and start looking at drag racing cases, or really the best example is felony murder, just to put it on the table, the most important is situations where if two accomplices commit a robbery, the store owner responds by killing felon two, can felon one be held liable for that death? And, you know, who's making that decision? How is that decision being made? I think probably the most accurate way to conceptualize that decision is as one of legal causation, and that, you know, the general rule seems to be that no, in those situations, felon one cannot be held liable for the death of felon two. District law, based on preliminary analysis, does not appear to have resolved it. Either way, should just say we haven't, you know, homicide is a ways down. So really the most important thing is to say is that these issues are on the radar. Yeah. We're going to think through them and we'll consider them as we move forward.
Oh, that's
to sum it up.
Because I'm like, I'm not convinced.
Right.
But if that's where we are, okay, fine.
Yeah. I have a different set of comments.
Okay.
Go. What does otherwise mean in that sense? Because otherwise makes it sound like remoteness is dependent upon an individual, and accidental is dependent. You should say to remote accidentally or otherwise dependent. So it makes it sound like those are dependencies as well. But I don't think that's what you mean.
Sorry.
What is otherwise? What work does the word otherwise mean in that sense? Because to say otherwise dependent, to me, suggests that remoteness is a dependency. Or accidentalness is a dependency.
Yeah.
So what is the concept of otherwiseness supposed to carry so that I know what work it's doing?
No, it's a good point. It's a good point.
Isn't it doing the work Renato wants done?
That's why I'm asking the question.
Yeah, no. So it's probably...
Yeah, I don't know if the sentence should be restructured.
No, it's a good point. I have to think, look back at my notes.
But excellent point. I don't know that we should wordsmith this. If we're going to wordsmith stuff, there's more stuff we can wordsmith ahead. So, just to be clear, I think on this, this is still in work. And I think like gun battle, you know, again, we can mark this in the next draft about to make note that, as USAO noted, you know, there's case law that absolutely, you know, particularly from the gun battle case law, that raises concerns about this. We're not going to resolve. I don't think we're going to resolve it fully now, but we will make some changes to the commentary to address this. We might change this language too, this otherwise, you know, and tweak this, change the factors a bit. But again, felony murder, gun battle doctrine, these are places where it's going to come up down the road. So regardless of wherever this goes now, it's those places down the road, it's going to have to get looked at again. So we'll flag it for that and we'll come up with a next step on this. And if you have more thoughts, great. But I do want to try to, you know, we're 3:30, so I want to get to...
So one wordsmithing kind of framing issue, key one that OAG raised, is... Can you pull up the document, Richard?
That's easier way to go.
So OAG points out that the way recklessness and negligence read, it's recklessness or recklessly means, colon, or negligence or negligently means, colon. And then the definition is not structured in a way that allows for plugging in, right? Like, as OAG very nicely phrases it, a tenet of a well-written definition for use in a code provision is that, niceties of grammar aside, the definition should be able to be substituted for the defined term in the substantive defense, and the sentence should retain its meaning. I mean, that could be like
a cup of coffee. With
yeah, if you were giving your kid, you know, like 10 lessons that he should, you know for life, that could be one of them. Now, that being said, there are exceptions to every rule, and it's not clear whether or not this is something that whether the principle should give way to the exception or what can be done. So. Just consider three different things. So,
and let me preface this to say, like, this is a stylistic matter.
Yeah, right? So, like, this is not substantive.
No,
it may be we're about to see some versions, and the punctuation's a little different. Something like, if you catch something that there's a substantive difference, great, note it for us. But, like, what we're trying to do is just figure out the best drafting way. So that's all we're concerned about.
Again, OAG's point, which is definitely right, is that to say recklessly or recklessness means, and then to go to three, you can't say it means in order to act recklessly as a result of circumstance. That's not English. Okay. So there's, I think, two options. One is to try and come up with a version where it is plain English, and OAG's tenet of drafting is respected. So the revised version right there is an attempt at that. I'll give a minute just to read through it. The key being that the gross deviation language is kind of accompanying each, and there's a semicolon and that.
Person is the same as one's in number one. Risk that one's conduct will cause the result, and that one's conduct grossly deviates from the standard of care.
Yeah.
So it's like that lead-in language is good for both. So with respect to a result, being aware of the substantial risk that one's conduct A will cause the result, semicolon, and B grossly deviates. You see how the lead-in is the same for both of the clauses.
So just to be up front, this is, I don't think, staff's preferred version.
Yeah. Staff, I'm just working with what
you're working with.
Yeah, no, just to say that in terms of the effort, the one problem with this with the reformatting is that, you know, even if you get it to the point where it all plugs in the right way, when you then draft an offense, right? So you draft, no person shall recklessly kill another person. It still doesn't work.
That's what I meant by niceties of grammar aside.
Okay.
That's exactly what I meant. So that you didn't need to worry about, it doesn't have to be a perfect matchup, no definition will be.
So that's the case. Richard, can you just go down to three?
Okay.
The sort of standard approach, to say, look back at my notes, no one does the recklessly means or negligently means. Yeah. I think that was something that we had just, it was from the prior iteration of the project. It was so entrenched, I just kind of went forward with it. And
you trained us well.
Yeah. but the sort of, most, if not all, reform jurisdictions as well as MPC don't even have like a pretense of like a recklessly means. Instead, they just say a person acts recklessly with respect. And so, in that situation, you don't have to worry about the plug-in.
That's my preferred way.
Oh, great.
I think when you use means, and I haven't read what you actually wrote,
but.
When you say means, it should be a definition that could be used. There are other ways of drafting it such that you don't have to box yourself into a definition, and that is certainly one of them.
And that's
it's
a way
an explanation
to get around a possession
as opposed to a definition.
Too, if it's not drafted in a way that it's a plugger.
We'll look at that too. I hear the point.
So you want
so
that bottom
theoretically, that bottom, I mean, I don't know what you said, but.
So then basically what we have here is just a slightly reformatted version of what was proposed, which, you know, doesn't have any pretense. And, you know, negligence, purpose, knowledge would all be kind of restructured in this way.
Can you pull back for a second?
That's just clearer anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's better.
Yeah, I like it incorporated in the paragraph. That was really...
Is that what you wanted to see, the top, the MPC version, or
well,
was there something else you wanted to see?
Well, I wanted to see if... Wouldn't it instead... No, you had it.
Okay, sorry.
Go ahead, pull back so that the upper example is in. Why do we need define?
The one.
Why do we need the word define?
Because the title of the stat of the
why then recklessness? That's what they do in model penal code jurisdictions. Then it's not a definition.
So just to be clear, Dave, I think that subsection 2.02 says culpable mental state definitions or like culpable mental state defined. So it's true.
That's why you want to define it.
Yeah, but no, we don't have to.
We can look at those captions.
I just
reevaluate this too. But it's
a fair point.
If people are fine with this type of approach, what we can do is just reformulate again. We'll have to do it for all the mental state. You know, this was just an example, but
I mean, I don't have a problem with definitions and putting means in there.
Okay.
To be clear, I like them.
Yeah.
But I don't need to think we need to be shoehorned by them.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool.
That, good.
Yeah.
Well, and these are different than most of the definitions. So, okay. Well, then that kind of answers
that
question, unless there's any concerns with it. Great.
So the last issue, which. That OAG raised that we thought would be worth discussing is what to do about the gross deviation factors. So, by way of background, the requirement of a gross deviation originates in the Model Penal Code, adopted throughout reform jurisdictions, and in many places, you know, it's core to the definition. Because there are lots of situations where someone may be aware of a risk, but still not criminal. The fact that they disregarded it, you know, the lots of driving to risky. So the gross deviation is really what that means, and sort of the contours of it is really important. And the Model Penal Code is kind of ambiguous on it, and there's a lot kind of stuff throughout their commentary. Courts throw things in by way of case law, but it's not ever really laid out and well structured. So what we tried to do is compile the factors that weigh on that gross deviation analysis. We put it in the commentary, and OAG's recommendation is, well, look, if these factors are so important, why don't we go ahead and codify them? And I think, you know, staff's position is, well, it's an interesting idea. It's, you know, so I should be clear, a lot of these factors come from, there's some really nice Alaska Supreme Court case law, which fleshes these out. They incorporate into their jury instructions, and they apply particularly helpful in distinguishing between depraved heart murder and this sort of, which is like enhanced recklessness versus the, you know, sort of standard recklessness. So, you know, the question is whether this is the sort of thing that ought to go in the statute as opposed to the commentary. And we kind of just want to open it up for discussion. We don't have strong feelings. Say, no one's codified factors in this way. It's not to say that we shouldn't necessarily do it, but
right. Well, would you say like these factors for, you know, what a gross deviation is, right? Like, you know, this kind of structure,
right?
Codifying that's been, you know, some jurisdictions do that, you know, and certainly in sentencing type provisions, you'll have codified, you know, oh, here are the factors to consider. So, you know, there's precedent for that, but specifically on what a gross deviation is, no jurisdiction right now codifies these factors. They exist. They're
cutting
in case
edge.
Law. Well, there you go. So, so right, you know, this is...
And from my point of view, I mean, I think I'm fairly consistent on this. My position is, for OAG, is that anything that's that important that comes up that often should be in the code and not in the
commentary. So that's the question, though, is... right, there's two aspects, that important and that often. So the frequency with, as far as, you know, staff can tell based upon the nationwide research, you know, that it's kind of done, it's the sort of borderline recklessness cases are not, you know, are, yeah, it's kind of like the exception rather than the norm. So if it were true that this you need this sort of careful contours of gross deviation analysis in every case, that would be one thing. But the hesitancy, I should just say, in terms of codifying them, is just the lack of frequency.
What's the downside?
Because the code's huge.
Yeah.
Because, oh, I don't care.
Except not, like, if we do this now, when don't we do it?
Well, if the code is going to have the commentary anyhow. Otherwise, it's not going to be useful, yeah, to anyone. So if it's going to have the commentary anyhow, I'd rather have it as a short paragraph in the code itself than in the editorial in Lexis, yeah, or Westlaw.
Yeah, I like, right. It's a big question. We can have this conversation, yeah, but I do think, like, this is a judgment call. Like, right, like, we don't see a clear, there's not, like, a clear problem with codifying this, although we have to be really careful then how we, you know...
Oh, no, wording
aside, about the
factors, not, yeah,
but,
yeah.
But,
yeah.
But you know, and we're going to hit this in other places too, and it's going to be, you know, we're just going to have to make judgment calls on this. I don't.
But I would just say that, I mean, in modern reform jurisdictions, you know, reliance on whether it's model penal code commentary or the whatever the commentary specifically underlying that jurisdiction, like Hawaii has a good one, I think like Washington, you know, where it's even on Westlaw, but it wasn't codified as part of the statute. It's whatever the drafter's commentary, let's say. Reliance in that way, I think, is pretty standard. That being said, you know.
Yeah, which is actually my response to Laura. If it's going to be printed anyhow, it might as well be in the code, is my position.
Well,
and I don't see a downside to having it in the code.
Yeah. Yeah,
anything that stops extra work, I'm in favor of. In other words, not having to look up commentary if somebody's just flipping through something and looking at what the elements are.
Right. No, and that's definitely right. The countervailing is if something's only coming up in 1 out of 1,000 cases, there's also this sort of time taken up by just distracting.
But you only have to look at it when the issue comes up of gross deviation, of what do you call it? Your gross deviation, right?
Yeah.
So you don't have to look at it in all the cases. But when the issue of gross deviation comes up, it should be a simple place to go to for it.
Just straw poll on this.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm not against
this
particular thing, you know, But I guess I sort of feel like it's a case-by-case basis of...
I agree with that.
You know, depending on, you know, like the possession stuff. I mean, at a certain point, you sort of feel like we can't keep defining each and every thing. And, you know, the reason why we got to this point was because of this thing here and this thing here and this thing here. But I don't...
Yeah, right.
I don't object to this.
Yeah, my issue with possession is not that. It's what the definition itself is.
It says, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you wanted some of the commentary in the code. You wanted the legislative intent in the code. Like, most things you think, stick it in the code. And I'm saying, I don't disagree with
this. That one wasn't mine, though. That was LCD.
Okay.
So
I don't disagree with this.
Yeah, like,
but saying I'm okay with this is not saying,
it's not
stick
finding
the entire,
your way.
Like, the entire
so I will say, like, one question that we would have to address is, so for causation, there are some factors put in the commentary for legal causation. Is there a legal difference intended by the drafters or by the counsel, let's say, by codifying some factors and noting other factors in the commentary only?
I would need somebody from appellate to explain to me how that argument would be structured.
Right.
I don't get that.
No, just,
I mean, to be honest, to me that's a fairly remote. If that's the best you got at the Court of Appeals.
Yeah. No, I know. Exactly. And at that point, you're rolling dice. What panel you draw is going to... Yeah.
Okay.
Well, good. We'll look at this. I think there's no objection and, you know, interest in it, so we'll look at codifying it in a way that's...
Pretty straightforward.
And, you know, we'll take a second look at some of these other places, like with causation, and see, like, well, what would that look like if it was codified instead of in commentary?
Yeah. So that's basically, in terms of the stuff that we want to raise, particularly, like, you know, OED, you guys had a host of great recommendations and points on a variety of issues that, like, we outlined up.
There was a lot more there than what happened to me. I think we did most of you as but, like...
These were just the things that seemed like most, you know, best resolved through kind of, like... group discussion.
And some will just like straight it, you know, make changes in this next one to reflect them. So, any other questions or concerns at this stage on the draft? Like, again, in the next 2 to 3 weeks, few weeks, along with voluntary intox and willful blindness, we'll get you an updated version on this.
And it's not with a lot of discussion, but you understood that we were giving you the Vines decision in connection with...
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. The question...
Recklessness as to result.
Yeah,
so that's... In the context of assault.
The question with Vines we looked at was there was some earlier language in the decision saying they were specifically not resolving the mens rea of assault. So the Vines decision is discussed in the memo, like introducing the general provisions, and we definitely are take a look at it.
And goodness knows, when we get to assault.
Okay, yeah.
We'll be back to Vines, and who knows? I bet there's probably even, who knows how quickly more case law is going to generate on that, but.
Yeah.
Great. If there's nothing else, we'll end a few minutes early then.
2 minutes?
Yeah.
Good?
Okay.
And again, I'll send out an email, or do you want to start the chain about alternative? Why don't you check your calendar
and
see what you can pitch? And
I'm going to be away on May 3rd.
So there
for the main meeting.
So we're
thinking maybe kick it back to the same time the following Wednesday, which is right.
When are you going to get that materials out?
For May?
May 3rd.
So in general, because we have to, like, print things in the register. We'll get like an agenda out well beforehand. This next bunch of materials will be within the next couple weeks. You'll get, well, that's not true. In a couple of days, you'll get some for the first report.
The question is,
okay.
I got to check when I'm going to be out of the country.
Yeah.
Whether it makes sense to move it back a couple of days.
I think back
rather
is,
than forward, as long as we have sufficient time to review the material.
Sure.
Which is why I was asking. It may be better. I don't know how other people's calendars to do the end of April, just before I leave, rather than just when I get back. I'm just putting that out on the table.
Yeah.
I'll send dates around, and people can respond as they need to.
Okay, yeah. I don't immediately have a strong opinion on that. We're going to have some stuff discussion-worthy coming out in April. Our goal is to have... Yeah, so... probably later, probably the week later rather than earlier.
Okay.
Probably be more productive.
Okay, I'm just checking what the options are.
Yep.
All right.
Great. Thank you all.
Yeah.
We'll turn the recorders off.
Same setup we were talking about before, about or otherwise.
Yes.